Welcome to Salon Talks. I'm Mary Elizabeth Williams, and I'm so excited today because we have with us Jill Soloway. Jill Soloway is an Emmy and Golden Globe Award winning writer, director, author, showrunner. They are the creator of Amazon's critically acclaimed series Transparent, the co-creator of I Love Dick, and let's give a shout out, the director of Afternoon Delight, the woefully underrated Afternoon Delight that you can, I'm assuming, stream somewhere now and should because it's charming and wonderful and sexy. They have a brand new book out now and it is called She Wants It, Desire, Power, and Toppling the Patriarchy. Yeah, because that patriarchy is not going to topple itself, is it?
No, it certainly isn't.
It's not going to topple itself. Jill, welcome.
Thank you.
So this book begins with a pivotal moment in your life with a phone call that you've, I'm sure, talked about in like every interview you've done over the last 7 years now.
Yeah.
But this moment was the lighting of a match.
Yes.
In your life, in your family's life, in your career, but then also it was really the beginning of a movement in general. Why do you think that moment of your father coming out to you as transgender female set off this, was part of setting off this revolution in gender and this conversation around gender in our culture?
Well, I think it really happened in these kind of incremental, really highly personal ways. It's funny because at the time that I wrote the pilot, I was trying to sort of write myself into a place where I wouldn't feel embarrassment or shame. I was fictionalizing reality so I could touch it and be in it. And the exercise of just creating the Pfeffermans and having them be able to say things that maybe I couldn't say was kind of like a self-soothing process, like wrapping myself in a world where I could start to have the feelings that I couldn't really have in real life. And then when I went out with that pilot and went to the usual suspects, the HBOs and the Showtimes, and pitched it, as a TV show, really they all passed. They all said no for different reasons. And Amazon said yes. At this point, Amazon was the place that I bought paper towels. And probably not even paper towels in bulk. It wasn't even that Amazon yet.
Right. It's just books.
It's probably just a book and maybe some nail clippers. And I thought, wow, this is an interesting path. But okay, like I'm gonna trust it and we'll see. You know, if it ends up not working on this Amazon shopping channel or whatever I thought it was, maybe I'll get the footage back and make a movie, make it my next movie. So I just kind of went with the process. And I think that what happened in this moment where Amazon was at a place where the risk they took by airing it matched up with my abilities as a showrunner, writer, director, I was really ready to do it at this point. I had been sort of toiling for 20 years, so I was personally ready as an artist. Amazon was absolutely ready as a platform to have something that felt different. And then the world was really ready for a story about transness on this medium, you know, where you could stream it, you could watch it whenever you wanted, wherever you wanted it, in any country, at any time, as much or as little as you wanted. It was sort of a perfect storm of those three things.
It's really impressive to me when I take a step back and I see how much has changed in just, it's been 4 years since the debut, really just almost to the day. It's just been 4 years.
Crazy.
And there was some trans representation before, like Orange is the New Black, but how much has changed? And you say you've been writing this, you started the process of writing this book 4 years ago.
Yeah.
A lot's happened. Like, we live in a very different world now, Jill.
Yes.
And you are writing, your book ends this year.
Yeah.
The narrative of it. How did you, how does the story keep changing as you're doing it in real time?
One of the things that I talk about is the heroine's journey as opposed to the hero's journey, and that the heroine's journey moves in the shape of a spring. That the female journey, the divided feminine, is about moving in circles and understanding the circles or the spheres in our life. And instead of feeling like you're going in circles, that you're actually kind of climbing a mountain. And so you're returning to the same place, but you're higher up and you have a better view. And this idea that the spring or the circle as a forward ambulating thing really gives me a lot of peace because it means we're learning, we're iterating, we're growing, but we're still moving forward, that concept. And so we do that creatively at work, We say, here's the first draft, but this isn't the final draft. We show first drafts really early to everybody and get everybody's feedback, very open. And I feel the same way about my identity and my process. Obviously I love being a TV writer, but I think of myself even more so as an activist and a feminist. And then I think of myself as an artist. And my art is making television. My art is making movies. My art is books. But actually, my particular practice involves exploring and revealing my personal life.
And doing it through all these different media. And yet, when you talk about this journey that we've been on, there's so much, I think, to celebrate over the last couple of years in terms of where we've come in the conversation, particularly around gender. And yet, also, you talk about, you win this Emmy, you make the declaration, topple the patriarchy, and it's, 6 weeks before November 8th, 2016, I believe?
I actually remember, yes, you're right, it was, yes, because I was backstage talking about Trump, right? Yeah.
So there's also been a lot of, the hero's journey, so the heroine's journey isn't always going in an upward momentum as well. How do you reconcile those two things in your own work and in your own art when you're looking out and you're seeing you're coming from a place where, as you say, 4 or 5 years ago, it never even was on the table as a point of conversation to cast a trans female in the role of Mara. It just wasn't even a thought.
Right.
And now you have this whole company where intersectionalism is just part of the creed, is baked into the system, and yet you turn on the news and it's like, oh my God, every day.
Yeah.
The sexism, the misogyny,
The patriarchy. Yeah, the patriarchy is a word that, even 3 or 4 years ago, you wouldn't want to say in mixed company or at a Hollywood meeting because people would think, like, well, why did Jill just get so academic? Like, what are they talking about? So we can see that politically, patriarchy means men protecting men, men having each other's backs, Trump protecting Kavanaugh. A whole bunch of men deciding that they're going to get to make decisions for women and their bodies, white men using their beliefs to create the realities of life for women, people of color, queer people, disabled people, that's sort of what patriarchy is in government. And then, I had this personal reckoning over the past few years where I would kind of look around at Hollywood and say, but we have so many liberal people in Hollywood. Every single person I know who is creating culture, books, movies, TV, songs, everybody's a liberal. So how did we go about creating a culture that elected Trump? That was this kind of like come to Jesus, feeling and fear I was having, which is why does it matter? If we make stuff, if we're not actually able to affect the consciousness of our culture. And then I started to realize that, we haven't been making, liberals haven't been making our stuff. White male liberals have. And people can't help it. Creativity is a propaganda for the self. Protagonism is propaganda for your own privilege. And so white men, as liberal as they are, have still been making content that centers their reality and turns women, people of color, women of color, queer people, into objects, into that. Oh, she's that. Oh, she's hot. Oh, he's fat. Oh, she wants it. She deserves sexual violence. The otherizing that is still inherent in what happens when men create culture is a continued kind of patriarchy, even coming from the left.
And you talk about late in the book having these moments of reckoning where a person will go up to a male entertainer, like the line about Marc Maron, I was just like, oh, come on. Of men in power, even men who we think of as edgy and alternative and liberal, saying, well, I'm just more comfortable around other men because they don't have to think about opening up.
Right.
The floor to other people.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Siri Husvet, she has a book called Women Looking at Men Looking at Women. and talks about this feeling of what men are doing at work, and it's a kind of competitive thing. They're like, it's like pick up basketball, but it's like jokes and it's competition and maybe trying to one up and this kind of like, what's up and hey, and like I just said something funnier than you, or I just came up with the, you know, algorithm more quickly to figure out how we're going to make money quickly. You know, if you hear VCs pitching, for example, it's all about speed and, you know, it's people just trying to kind of like prove, you know, I'm faster, I'm funnier. It's got kind of like a sports and like an athletic vibe. And I think white men want to do that with other white men. Siri Husvet says that there's a secret algorithm in there, and if you dunk on a woman at work, it's not worth as many points.
Yeah.
Because for the other men, they're just like, well, it doesn't count as a woman. So yeah. There's this kind of like secret code amongst men, capitalism, competition, that involves a kind of poking and even a kind of like emotional shorthand, where if you have women and people of color, then I think men think they have to be more careful and they can't play their game, which is work, which is ambition, which is speed, which is, you know, I'm going to be callous, I'm going to be fast, I might insult you. And so I think that would make sense why white men, even liberal white men, when writing comedy would want to be surrounded by other white men, because they want to be able to just like be free and say whatever they want, and they don't feel that they can when women or people of color are in the room.
And you work.
And by the way, it sounds like I'm defending that. I just want to make sure I'm indicting that.
No, I get it.
I just want to make sure it's clear I'm indicting that way of working.
That's not the paradigm.
That is not the paradigm. I feel for them. I understand why they made that choice, but it is no longer acceptable or appropriate.
That's why we want to topple that patriarchy.
Yes.
And you know, you worked within that system, within those constraints,
yes,
for a long time.
Yep.
And I have to thank you so much, because you were very honest in this book and you were very vulnerable and you really just open yourself up to saying, I'm still processing all of these things, mm-hmm, as well, and I'm still figuring it all out as well, of coming on this journey. And that journey includes looking at my own gender,
yeah,
and my own gender expression as well. And you say early on in the book, I love the expression, of starting to think that you were meeting this other part of yourself.
Mm.
That you hadn't seen before. And when you start leaning into that,
mm-hmm,
you're also interrogating these ideas around masculinity and,
yeah,
femininity.
And femininity, yeah.
Right. And that is so interesting and so, I think, needed right now, because it's hard to be honest about that and about what do we think masculinity means,
mm-hmm,
and what does it mean? You talk about sort of taking on the more masculine role in a relationship and what that looks like,
mm-hmm,
and the power that comes from that.
Yeah.
And that's separate from the patriarchy though, right?
Yeah, masculinity when, you know, and patriarchy are two different things. So when a man is expressing masculinity, when a man of power is expressing masculinity in a way that is pretend, you know, whatever, not expected or not appreciated, he has patriarchy at his back as a wind, which is supporting his expression of masculinity. So men expressing power and masculinity are doing so within the language of patriarchy. But a woman expressing masculinity may be doing so to interrogate patriarchy. So masculinity and patriarchy aren't the same. And in fact, Julia Serrano, who's an amazing trans philosopher, really hates the division that says masculinity is strong, femininity is weak, masculinity is honest, femininity is, you know, is a trick. You know, there are all these things that we think about the words masculinity and femininity, and the more you start to ask yourself what they mean, like, at really all of these conceptions of gender don't really ever do much to help us. They mostly separate us into groups. And in these gendered groups, the rules change, and I haven't been able to come up with a place where a separated gender group that says men only, or women only, or even for that matter, masculine people only, feminine people only, I haven't been able to come up with a place in my mind where I think that's actually something positive.
Yeah, but we're still, and that's still an evolution, and you talk about the way that language really can inform and empower, or by the same token, hold us back. And being at the beginning of creating this show, wrestling with the idea of this concept of cross-dressing,
mm-hmm,
and saying, how do we, in this moment in history, in 2014, talk about something that was part of of your father's experience and understanding of the world 30 a generation ago, because that was the language.
Yes, yeah, straight. A lot of trans women who grew up thinking they were straight men also found that the closest identity to what they felt like was what people would call cross-dressers in those days.
And talking about, and then the evolution of that to talking about transsexual, and then evolving now to this place where we can use words like non-binary and genderqueer. Mm-hmm. And you see what's happened. Once we have these words, then people start using that.
Yeah.
And saying, oh, that's what I am.
That's what I feel like, right?
That's what I feel
like. Oh, there's going to be an M and an F, and then there's an X on the driver's license as a choice. I think in New York, they've done it in California. I think New York is offering the X box on...
birth certificates?
Birth certificates, yeah. And, you know, just the fact that you can choose it. So somebody like me who's very actively saying I identify as non-binary, I use the they pronouns. I can go down to the DMV in California and say, let's change my gender marker to X. And I can do so, you know, very proudly and easily because of my privilege. But I think there are a lot of people who really wouldn't necessarily vigorously go grab that X marker. But when asked to complete a form in a private place, might then say, well, wait a second, what is this other one? What is this other thing that leaves space for both? And those people could be people like really butch lesbians. That could be people like drag queens. That could be people who just internally feel very much both gender or the opposite gender they were assigned at birth. And who knows, they may find themselves checking that X box. And it's my belief that it's possible that this could create a new class of people who connect around a certain way of feeling other.
Yeah, and you, and that's something that you really had to, because just even 5 years ago, those tool that all of those tools in the vocabulary kit and all of those options on your driver's license form or your birth certificate form didn't yet exist.
Yeah,
and you're really part of changing that conversation and being in some ways the canary in the coal mine yourself and being so open about it.
Thanks. Yeah, I feel in some ways like I'm sacrificing myself and my privacy to be that canary. And other times I feel, you know, that this must have something to do with my purpose, and I'm just going to keep trying to sort of stand up on the wave of it.
And yeah, and just, like I said, it's really interesting reading a book from someone who says, like, I still don't have all the answers. Mm. And there's a moment late in the book that I really love, and I was talking to my daughter about, where you're talking with your mappa, and you just say, you know, we're all just trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And giving each other the space to mm-hmm. say that, as opposed to, here's where you are, mm-hmm. here's the box that you get put into, and you better stay in that box your whole life.
Yeah.
As opposed to maybe there's something outside the box.
Yeah.
So in part of toppling the patriarchy, which is not about being male or female, but just the entity itself, it's a year ago, you're excited about the patriarchy starting to come down, and then Jill, you start to realize that maybe the calls are coming from inside your house.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
And it's a chapter in your book that you call Oh Fuck. And you're also writing the book while this is experienced.
Yes, that's true.
How does that happen when it's all hitting the fan at the same time?
Yeah, well, I think I wasn't exactly writing right when it was happening, because I think my first response was, I can't write a book anymore. I have to just hide under the sand because this is too overwhelming. And I don't know what happened, because when I yelled topple the patriarchy on stage, I didn't expect any of it to come toppling down atop me and us and our show. But, you know, the women who sacrificed themselves to come forward, Trace Lissette and Van Barnes, did something so risky for themselves personally, and something that ultimately had to happen. And I think the ways in which I reacted at first, where I was kind of like, I don't want this to be true, you know, I'm ashamed of now, because I wish I could have just been more vigorously ready to take up their charge. And I guess I think I was in this odd position that I was kind of a manager slash owner. It was my show. It was my family history. It was my livelihood. It was the livelihood of a bunch of people. And so my response as a feminist couldn't be the same as my response as a human. It just took me a while to move through and get to a place where I felt like I was, you know, in integrity with myself.
And yet, in writing about that and in being honest about that and talking about how, yeah, your first reaction was like, oh, fuck, and I don't want this to be true, and mm-hmm. I'm disappointed, and I'm disappointed for this show mm-hmm. that I created and I love, like, that's also part of it. And mm-hmm. it's good for us to talk about that. Like, it's okay to be disappointed in people.
Yeah.
And to be disappointed in the people in our lives
yeah.
when it turns out they're disappointing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
As a first reaction. Because yeah. sometimes it takes a while, and you talk about living in that space of taking a breath and how you've talked with your therapist about mm-hmm. this, and you have to, you know, these moments in life where you have to take a step back. Mm-hmm. And it feels like we live in such a reactive culture.
Yes.
And everybody wants, what's your response right away?
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, you really did say, I need time.
Mm-hmm.
That yeah. must have been not what people wanted to hear from you, right,
yeah.
Rachel?
Yeah. I mean, I think people really wanted to very quickly come up with a decision and get back to work. And I really get that. But so much of what we do at work involves a feeling of mutual trust and safe space and risk-taking that, you know, I don't think we could have just constructed it quickly. We had to go through all of the different stages, including the pain and the anger and the healing, you know, like the naming of the trauma, you know, groups where we could process together, asking ourselves what it would feel like to move through it, grieving, grief, understanding it as trauma, you know, all of the things that happen, you know, when trauma occurs in a family, you know, occurred in our TV family.
Yeah, and that is a process that requires thoughtfulness and not just a knee-jerk response. And yet, here we are now, a year later, and we've come a little further circle, and mm-hmm. now there have been some new developments.
Yes, we're making a musical movie of Transparent. So my sister Faith is a brilliant songwriter. I've always seen her as, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Stephen Sondheim. Like, my sister is a genius and has been writing songs about the Pfefferman family and even the Soloway family for the past decade. Actually, Faith and I started out just like writing songs on the piano as little kids. So it's our co-worship of each other and trust in each other and faith in each other around creativity that really has given birth to everything I do and is giving birth to this next phase of the Pfeffermans, which is going to be a movie musical.
A movie musical. So, like, theatrical or?
It's going to be released on Amazon. I definitely have, like, the tour, you know, Tent Revival, JCC. You know,
but kind of like when the
rock
Glee,
tour.
When the Glee kids went on tour.
Yes, I want to go to every JCC in the country with it. And yeah, I'm really excited about it because it kind of has this up in a way joyful feeling where the Pfeffermans can really, you know, transition their relationship with the audience into the world of musicals.
It sounds like a perfect and beautiful sweet ending.
It's
to
so beautiful and sweet
to you know, a tumultuous time.
Yeah.
Jill, the book is called She Wants It. I'm gonna say it again: Desire, Power, and Toppling the Patriarchy. It is such a great book, and it's inspired so many interesting conversations around my own dinner
table.
Awesome. And it's like super awesome, Jill. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Book.